I was just giving advice to a client the other day to test some things that they don't think would work, partly because we're not very good predictors of what would work. It's why we test, right? And giving yourself the space in the room to do that means you're giving yourself a chance to get out of a rut, to stop saying the same things you've been saying or the things that appeal to you and people like you and the people in your bubble.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guests today are Josh Berezin and Mary Bogus from Grow Progress. Mary is research strategy lead and Josh is a co-founder. I spoke with Josh previously back in 2019. Grow Progress is one of the post-Trump political tech startups that has found a way to grow substantially. So we talked about persuasion and message testing and how they've gone about building a company to help in that area. It's a good catch-up. If you're following progressive political tech, you should definitely listen. So first, my sponsor, then my interview with Josh and Mary at Grow Progress.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Josh and Mary, would you each mind introducing yourselves and giving me quick biographies?
Sure. I'm Josh Berezin. I grew up in the woods outside a small town in Alaska, conservative little town in the snow to liberal hippie parents. After college and sort of falling out of love with software engineering, if I was ever in love with it in the first place, stumbled my way into politics. And you know, the rest is a career bio that's taken me all sorts of places that we can talk about too. But all of that led to being here.
You were with your co-founder on this podcast in 2018. And if people want to hear more about your biography or what Grow Progress looked like quite some time ago, it's an interesting historical document and I refer you to it. Mary, what's your story?
Yeah, it's funny. Josh and I think, have some similarities in our experience. I did not grow up in Alaska, but I did grow up in a very small rural community in central Wyoming. Also, two very liberal hippie parents. We kind of always joked that we were probably the only Democrats in the entire state of Wyoming. I don't think we were far off, but that wasn't quite exactly true. Yeah, I've been in political advocacy. I was actually thinking about this ahead of time. It'll be 15 years since I took my first political job in February this month.
What was that first political job?
I was a canvasser. I was a paid canvasser. And in such as I think typical, because I was hardworking, I was like smart enough. In about 4 months, I was running the entire office. That was the first time I was working probably 100 hours a week, which when you're 23, like, that's doable. I can't say at almost 38 that I would be able to even do half of that in 1 week. I think probably my most like formative kind of political job experience was when I was the organizing director at Planned Parenthood of the Rocky Mountains, which is the affiliate for Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, and strangely enough, just Las Vegas. I worked on legislative campaigns. I worked on a lot of ballot initiatives, and also ran all of our like youth organizing programs. So that was, as a practitioner, I think the place where I kind of like really cut my teeth, to, so to speak, in political advocacy and organizing before I came to Grow Progress. So I did a bunch of stuff kind of in between. But right before Grow Progress, I was the lead program strategist at the Analyst Institute. So I oversaw kind of the advising and sort of training services that AI provides. I came to Analyst Institute as a practitioner, a former practitioner, not necessarily a researcher, but I think I was always very driven by this question of, is anything that we're doing like actually working? Like, is this the right thing to be doing? And I think especially in, you know, organizing, there's a lot of stuff that I think like feels like instinctively right and effective, but I was really interested in like, how can we actually measure these things? And so then, you know, I've been at Grow Progress just a little bit under 2 years. I oversee our research strategy team. You probably got the sense of this from the last time that you talked to us. The platform is really meant to be DIY, very accessible, but, you know, we know that a lot of folks are wanting kind of more support and thought partnership when it comes to like designing research plans and interpreting results. So that's kind of what my team does.
Well, the combination of what you just told me and then what I've seen when I was researching your history seems like you had quite a lot of strong background that fits with Grow Progress. I would ask Josh to just kind of update me and whoever might have listened to him before. My guess is that Grow Progress has changed quite a bit since 2018 and learned a lot and done a lot of things. Could you sort of summarize what are the big changes? How has the enterprise grown? And what is it?
Well, I mean, Grow Progress has always been a persuasion company. Like, our mission has always been to help people persuade more effectively. But our theory of the case and our theory of change here has evolved so much. We started out with some models that told stories about people's, you know, moral values and worldviews, that we use some novel approaches to generate that we thought would be really essential to persuading people, voters on issues. I think we met, I don't know, sometimes skepticism or confusion or like, this doesn't solve a problem we have. And we're like, no, really, it does. Let us prove it to you. We'll run these randomized controlled trials to prove that this approach works. I think what we ended up finding, and I'm glad we had our eyes open to it, was that that second part was something really valuable and really needed. People wanted to be able to run randomized controlled trials at a high speed, at a reasonable budget. It unlocks so many different things, and we can get into that. But we ended up building our company around that. So, like I said, we're focused on helping people be as persuasive as possible, but the tools that enable that have just changed so much to center around testing of message and creative, and also even to complement testing with tools to help people and understand their audiences better, be inspired by what other groups in the space are doing, and other things to help get their, you know, their initial messages, their inputs into testing to have an even better chance of being effective as well.
Do I discern there a notion that the values idea wasn't as powerful as you hypothesized, but that there was a lot of value in figuring out whether it did, and that's where you formed a company around? Or is there still something important about that that values part that you mentioned, and which I remember you emphasized a lot when we did talk before?
The startup lingo for the problem we had is not having product market fit. That is to say, like, we had a solution to a problem people didn't perceive they had, at least, right?
Hard to sell that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, and this is such an interesting lesson learned from a startup perspective. Like, you go around with your idea and you're enthusiastic about it, and people will tell you like, hey, that sounds like a really good idea. That's very cool. They'll give you this positive feedback. But the real signal is in whether they buy it or not, right? So we learned that. And it's just such a new space for, you know, for those of us on this company.
So was it that they wouldn't buy it or that it didn't work?
Oh, it was that they wouldn't buy it. And we still incorporate sort of an evolved version of that values approach into our tools now. When you're running one of our, what we call it, rapid message tests, one of the things you can do is get the value segments that we've mapped the entire electorate to as subgroups in your experiment. That is to say, you can see how your messages perform in these distinct groups of people who have, you know, a worldview, hopes and fears in common with each other and different from the other ones. That's still incredibly valuable guidance for differentiating your messages and unlocking parts of the electorate that you might not otherwise have a message that resonates with them.
So is it the case that frequently a message works dramatically differently in different value segments?
It is. And furthermore, a message will read and be completely different if you author it with one or another of those value segments in mind.
I think when we talked, Grow Progress was very small, not very many people. Maybe it was just the two of you. I can't remember. What is it now?
We may have been four or five when we spoke.
That sounds more right, yeah.
We probably have that many job openings right now. We're approaching 50.
That is actually rather unusual among the people that had startups in the 2017-2018 range post-Trump. I don't remember when you guys exactly first formed, but I think it was in that cohort, basically. What do you think it was that enabled you to have something that had legs and could grow?
Boy, so many things. Not giving up, having gotten really lucky in some of our early hires in data science and engineering. Matt and I were talking the other day, and we were like, what was the value proposition we were offering to a potential hire then? Like, why would someone be crazy enough to come and work for us? But if you also see something in the mission and the potential of it, maybe that's what we had to offer. And I guess the humility and curiosity to be wrong and recognize it eventually and respond to what we're hearing and learning from people. Like, we could have just hammered that idea into the ground and run out of resources and shut down. But I think we listened just enough to continue that, to pivot, to get that momentum up.
That seems like generically very good advice to listen to among any kind of startup of almost any type, right? Like, it is rare to have the product market fit that you mentioned in your head. Some people do, but mostly you have to be listening and you have a kind of an iterative process of developing something with the space. Mary, what did you see in Grow Progress that attracted you to a job or made you think this is a place I'd like to be?
I will say, Josh and I, we met on Josh's second tour of Analyst Institute. And so we got to know each other and worked together a little bit. And so when...
And despite that, you decided
to... Yeah. Must have been a really, really good, really good pitch. No. Josh kind of came to me and was like, hey, we have this tool. We're trying to build out this team. I think this is like something that is like really up your alley and kind of your skill set. Like, I would love for you to like think about applying for this. I have no tech background. This is the first time I have ever worked at a tech company, the first time I've ever worked at a startup. I worked in the nonprofit world, which I think is like in many ways has like a startup mentality of like literally everybody does everything. And I think for me, you know, coming from Analyst Institute, who is known for running really large scale, for the most part, randomized controlled trials, field experiments. I worked with a lot of people in terms of like not necessarily folks that were running field experiments. Like I definitely worked with a few, but my job was really more about like, okay, we have this body of evidence. How do you actually take what we are learning and apply it to your program, apply it to your problem? And there were so many groups that I worked with that had these really interesting research questions, but they didn't necessarily have the budget, the capacity, the infrastructure, frankly, to be able to run a field experiment. And so I think for me, the idea of having a platform to be able to do this kind of pre-testing, I think there's like a lot of different uses for a platform, but that's a lot of folks like to do sort of content testing before they spend a bunch of money to put stuff out in the field. But I think we have also been trying to work with a lot of our clients to think more about just like a general culture of learning. And so thinking about budgeting for research and being able to start asking some of these questions sooner versus I'm going to test this video that I want to put up on Facebook. That was like the really big draw, is just the level of accessibility that having a platform that can do this rigorous type of testing that, you know, that I was really interested in, and being able to answer a lot of different questions with a lot of different budgets and timelines and programs. And to me, that was the thing that I think was like, yeah, like I want to help more people. I want to get out of people's way and let them like ask these questions that they have and help them figuring out what is the question that they're trying to ask and help them figure out like, okay, you ran this test. Like, what does this mean? What's your next step? So I think for me, that ability to really open the doors for people to have access to RCTs was like the biggest pull. And like, I like Josh well enough.
Yeah, got it. Josh, I have a kind of a long-term interest in the kinds of things the Analyst Institute does, which Mary referenced. In fact, I recently interviewed Don Green and David Nickerson, who are professors who are kind of at the birth of get out the vote and testing around it using these field type trials. I think that the same way the medical profession can really only learn things with double blind randomized tests, certain types of things, the political world can only learn certain types of things this way. At the same time, when you deal with human beings and you deal with things like persuasion, there are sometimes unexpected kind of chaotic system developments that aren't as predictable. You can't necessarily put up a test and get the results that might be the long-term results of this if lots of things happen in the system, if something becomes viral or gets attacked, or it is a complicated thing to think about persuasion. I was talking recently to a media consultant named Colin Rojero. I asked him about like message testing. My general sense from him is there is a place for kind of political knowledge and expertise and a sense of history and experience that message testing or analogous experiments involving persuasion doesn't get at, because you miss some of these bigger patterns. How do you think about persuasion in a political system? I know that you guys have an expertise in that. What do you think the kinds of things that you do work for, and what kind of things do they not work for? And if that isn't my longest question on this podcast, it might be close.
Yeah, and I'm trying to figure out whether to answer the first part of that question or the second part.
That's the beauty of this. You can do what you want. I'd be interested in your answer to any and all of it.
I think one of the things we learned, or we knew and we started to build tools for, one of the things we knew that having built a message testing platform, our work was not complete. Right? Your consultant with their sense of the big picture and putting their finger into the wind and all the understanding that they and context that they bring to the question of persuasion should not inform whether they test or not, but it should inform what they test. I was just giving advice to a client the other day to test some things that they don't think would work, partly because we're not very good predictors of what would work. It's why we test, right? And giving yourself the space and the room to do that means you're giving yourself a chance to get out of a rut, to stop saying the same things you've been saying or the things that appeal to you and people like you and the people in your bubble.
I remember that Colin's example was the Apple ad in 84 with the hammer through the screen. I think his notion was that kind of ad would have never made it through testing, but it was still a notable ad. And I have no way of measuring. It certainly is one of those things that augmented Apple's reputation as a masterful marketing enterprise.
I know that ad well, and it's interesting. I guess it wouldn't test well, or it wouldn't get through testing. It depends on what you're measuring for. You just said that that ad, you think it increased Apple's reputation as a master marketer. You can test for that. And actually, that's one of the things.
Well, you could test for that after it ricocheted around the ecosystem or the population. But would you be able to, I think the point is, would you be able before that kind of thing happened, just having some number of people look at it, would you be able to foresee how something like that broke through or didn't?
I mean, I'll be the first to admit that there are different research methods for different kinds of research questions. But even within the like message testing space, it's been really important to us to give people the flexibility to test for the attitudes, beliefs, or opinions that we're trying to change. And that's not always like increased vote share for a Democrat in some place. Like, people's theories of change are diverse. And in an ideal world, we're coming at a bunch of related problems with different theories of change and using different persuasion mechanisms to bring people along. I mean, that ad, and people should go look at it, it's very distinct, kind of has a shock and awe, you know, impression that it leaves on people. That was, I expect, Apple's aim in creating it. And that's probably something measurable. Maybe we'll plug it into the platform.
So tell me about persuasion from your point of view, and what do you think your platform is most helpful for and maybe least helpful for?
I think it's kind of sad or hard for us as a movement that so few of us working in progressive advocacy and political campaigning have the chance to engage in deep learning about what persuasion is and what the pathways to changing minds are. I certainly didn't ever have that. I think there are tons of like personal theories and ideas that get passed around. Since we're not generally schooled in it and we don't have tight feedback loops that tell us what works, it's really hard to learn in. If there's one principle I try to raise up for people who are thinking about what they're going to test, what they're going to say to some people, is that their first job is understanding the people who don't currently agree with you and getting some sense of why, getting some sense of what holds them back, getting an understanding of what pressures there are on them, or whether they even care about the thing you're talking to them about. It, like, at its deepest level, that's like true empathy and respect for the people you're persuading. That's a really powerful jumping off point for persuading. There's all sorts of studies and psychology and specific tactics that you can use to persuade someone. And they're very cool. They're very useful. But this deeper one is really the core of it.
Mary, what do you think are the best practices for understanding whether something is persuasive or not?
Starting with what Josh said, is understanding the folks that you are trying to move, their opinions, their values, their beliefs, their actions. Understanding that you can't just sort of stronghold someone into changing a deeply held belief or even just like a slightly held belief. So I think like approaching any sort of persuasion program with a little bit of humility, that sort of understanding people, understanding their values. And I think trying to let go of some assumptions that you have about those people. I think that's why we talk so much about like trying to understand people's values versus the more traditional way that we've like targeted voters in the past, which is like based on demographics. So I think being able to understand like what makes those folks tick, what are the things that are decision points for them, what are the things that people, we tend to be really interested in sort of like self-preservation. And so I think being really honest about like the things that people need to feel safe and secure in their world. And I think like then being able to incorporate some sort of research. Obviously, we talk a lot about testing. RCT is a sort of like the gold standard of being able to say that, yeah, that thing that we tried, that strategy that we tried, we can actually point to that and say like this thing worked. Josh talked a little bit about the values and the messaging. I think another thing for persuasion is also having to think a little bit outside of the box in terms of like how you're presenting information to people. We know that persuasion is really hard. We know that it is really hard to move people, even a couple of points towards a candidate or towards an issue. And so as much as you can also sort of cut through that noise, like cut through the traditional political ads, you know, of like a candidate, like walking around with his kids and his family. We talk a lot to our clients about like trying stuff out. And I think this is also like, again, when I was talking before about like the accessibility of this kind of testing is like, it's really low stakes to be able to like throw some stuff at the wall. I'll tell people like, get a little weird, like try some stuff out, like try some stuff out that you think like you wouldn't normally think of for a persuasion ad. One of Josh and I's like favorite examples is one of our partners out of Michigan. They had some like consumer type data from us that showed that the folks that they were interested in had an interest in sort of like things like horoscopes. And so they put together this like Ouija board style of ad that was incredibly effective. And we've had some of their like channel partners. There was a group out of Nevada that did this like horoscope ad for one of the candidates. And I love talking about those because like, I've never seen an ad like that before. Like I've never seen something like that. And so they took this really interesting approach. They really tried to understand their audience's interest. And then they just tried some weird stuff. Some of it worked, some of it didn't. I always joke, I love a null result. Like a null result is really helpful information. And it's just something that is going to stand out. And I think that's a really important piece is like, you can have a really great message, but if people aren't paying attention to it, then it doesn't matter.
That's maybe why you throw a hammer at a screen. But Josh?
There's an exercise that I really like to encourage folks to do that I'd raise up here, which is like, you've generated some message. Think of all the reasons why it might not work. Maybe it's because it doesn't capture people's attention. Maybe it's because the people around them at their dinner table or, you know, in their social groups hold a different position. Maybe it's that they don't understand the language you're using. Like, brainstorm all of those because those are all pathways to strengthening your message or differentiating your message and giving yourself a chance to break through it. It's like such an essential exercise.
That makes sense. Josh, to help people understand exactly what you do and how it works, could you give me an example of a client of yours, a thing that they were trying to persuade an audience about, how they used you to be more successful at doing that, which I gather is what your place is?
That's the promise, right? Mary, I think you have some of these queued up, right?
There's like a couple that come to mind. One that I'm thinking of is there was a client who their kind of goal.
Can you say the name of the client? I mean, I think it's the more concrete we can be, the more I think it'll be intelligible by someone like me.
Yeah. So this client in particular, I'm not totally sure if these tests were shared publicly. So I want to be a little bit careful about that, but I will try to, if we have an example, I will try to say some folks specifically. So this group in particular, they were interested in finding messages to reduce support for like anti-protest legislation. And we worked with them to approach this from the long game of like a legislative session. They started testing early, and one of the tools that they ended up using a lot was we have the ability to do opposition message testing. And so the way that the platform sets it up is that folks will see your opposition's message first, and then they will see your message. And then we ask them the measurement questions. So, you know, it helps folks understand like, how effective are those opposition messages? Are your messages actually helping neutralize that at all? They took it a step further and they did like four different messages from their actual opposition. And they tested those not in the like opposition message test structure, but like our regular test structure. And what they found is that like none of these messages that their opposition was using as like their primary messages actually did anything. Like they didn't actually move people away from the thing that we were trying to do. Again, just like giving yourself time to be able to like learn those lessons can be really important for not just like your goal, but also like your budget and your timeline. They were able to kind of pivot and say, oh, I think we actually can kind of just leave this message alone. Like, we don't actually have to respond to this message. That's really, really important for our work, is like knowing when these messages, these opposition messages, like actually do anything.
Supposing there's an issue that we know is going to very likely be fought out in the election. Like, take, for example, border security, the House refusing to pass legislation that they requested of the administration and the Senate being prepared to do this, and then clearly for electoral reasons, the House backing away from that, and maybe because of Trump not wanting to have the current government have success on this, wanting to run on this. So we kind of have the landscape of how we're going to battle that out, and it's been used in a special election in New York, right, already successfully by the Democrats in that particular district and that particular candidate. How might people who are going to be involved in that aspect of the fight employ what you do to help sort out different variations of what works in this area of political combat?
It's a great question, right? There's all these different angles that you could attack that issue at, right? You could say the Republicans, they're actually hypocritical. They say one thing and they do another. You could say they're incompetent. They, you know, wrote this legislation or co-wrote it and didn't even vote for it. You could say that they don't really believe it. That's not really something they want to do, and those aren't their values. A million other variations, right? I have, you know, my own hypotheses about which of those might work or not work. And then you can explore, you know, which messengers can credibly and effectively convey those arguments to someone. You could talk about the impacts, and you could use personal stories, and you could find out whose personal stories are the most effective. You could, you know, make efforts to humanize the individuals affected by it and use that as a lever to persuade. But we just don't know which of those are necessarily going to move the needle. And so developing those and testing them is, like, you know, I would argue is the pathway to figure out the strategy around something like that.
Let's say you've generated these arguments. Are they video? Are they text? How are they submitted to the people that you're providing them to, who are giving you feedback? Who is that? How does this work?
Yeah, let me talk a little bit about how it works, and then I'll pass it to Mary to talk about how to use it, if that makes sense. We want live human people who we present basically a survey, an interview to. We recruit those people through a number of different firms. And we do all kinds of quality checks at the firm level and at the individual respondent level. But their experience is basically they're taking a survey, usually on their phone, maybe on their tablet or their computer, but in some digital context. One day the survey might be about Procter & Gamble products or whatever, you know, and the next day it happens to be about politics. They are asked some basic demographic questions. Unbeknownst to them, they are randomized into one condition or another, which means ultimately they see some content, whether it's some text or a video or audio file or a still image file. And then they're asked some more questions. Those after questions are the opinions or attitudes or beliefs that we're trying to shift. And, you know, in aggregate across 1,000 people or 2,000 people, seeing these different ads or seeing a placebo ad that has nothing to do with politics, the analysis shows us which of those actually is moving the attitudes or beliefs and by how much. So that's the process. And I think I implied a sort of flexibility in terms of what kind of content you put in there. But we have recommendations about when to use which kind of content and why. And I think Mary can talk about that.
Yeah, I think... So Josh mentioned like the types of content that you can upload to the platform. So you can do just text, a couple sentences. You could do an audio file, actually. You can do video, and then you can, of course, do images. The way that sort of the setup works, and again, we try to make this as like easy and intuitive as possible because it's a DIY tool. Like, you don't have to be a data scientist to be able to run a test with GrowProgress. But so you pick your audience, kind of the folks that you're interested in recruiting from. And then you pick, we call them your success questions. In the world of experimental evidence, this is what your dependent variables are. So these are the outcomes that we're trying to measure whether or not we move people. So people get to pick those. And then they upload their content and they hit submit. And then in a couple of days, they get their results back. So again, like we try to make it as easy as possible. A lot of times we will recommend that folks, like if they're kind of starting, you know, people come to us at all different places in terms of like where they're at with their research plans. We'll have folks come in that are doing a ton of different research. They have done polling, they may have done focus groups. And so they're at a place where they want to test like a video content. We have some folks that are asking a new question for the first time. And so I think for folks like that, a lot of times we're like, start with just some like text messages. Don't necessarily use the time and resources to create a really polished video yet. Like, let's try to learn some stuff first. Obviously, some groups have the capacity to just like put a video together really quickly. But a lot of folks will start with this kind of like persuasive message. We test that, we sort of see what we learn from that, and then kind of go from there. That kind of iteration will look different for each client and kind of what their goal is. But as much as possible, we try to encourage folks to do a couple of rounds of testing and to try to learn and iterate and make tweaks. And a lot of times too, like when you're testing, you will get results. And I think for a lot of folks, like new questions come up for them. Why did this work? Why didn't this work? I really thought that this thing was going to work and I need to like assess a little bit like why this thing didn't work. And so, and then after folks like do a couple of rounds, maybe they do some opposition testing, is then a lot of times when folks will start doing, creating like actual content that they want to put out in the world. So I think that's like a good kind of overview of how the platform actually works.
Josh, when you think about the different organizations that can help progressives figure out what works, who else might they go to beyond you? And what distinguishes what you do from what others do? Because there are other enterprises out there.
The biggest who else is polling firms, which do something I think really different from what we do, even though both our methods employ surveys, right? Knowing what people think now is such a valuable starting point, right? And tracking opinion change over the course of, you know, an electoral cycle or sort of whatever timeline is important to your organization. The findings from that kind of research and the qualitative research that pollsters do too, like focus groups, are definitely jumping off points for creating messages. But you come to us to learn rigorously what changes people's minds and develop that feedback loop, like I think I said before, so that you can learn and iterate and move forward. Yeah, that's how we distinguish them.
But what about non-polling competitors?
You know, there are some out there, of course, and I think you probably talked to the folks at those organizations. I guess I have a couple of thoughts there. First of all, it's pretty exciting and important that we have a space now that supports this kind of testing enough that there are multiple organizations doing it and thriving in that. I think that's awesome. And it's awesome for anyone offering that. Everyone in the space has a slightly different lane. And I mean, I'm most comfortable talking about ours, right? What we're aiming to do is closer to like democratizing this kind of testing, building tools that are highly flexible and that are understandable and operable by people who aren't researchers, right? And that's really like our sweet spot.
So who is an ideal client for you? What's the type of entity that's the best fit for what you do and that you most wish would use you that's out there that isn't?
to me, like, I'm always interested in entities that have some really specific expertise in an issue or an audience or a mode or a way of researching even. I mean, I will talk about one of our clients here that I often can't help but talk about, but this organization Galvanize and its like related entities have an approach to thinking about persuasion and their audience and the research process around it that uses us and other tools, but it has that humility and curiosity that's important for persuasion. It's just as important for using research tools to drive toward what's most effective. Anyone coming with that mindset is who I'm excited to work with.
One of the types of research entities that I've run into is the people who maintain these panels, online panels, like YouGov. There's a number of them. It's intriguing to me that you can watch opinions change over time among the same people, not just a different random sample. In the case of your work, is that an element of what you do where you have a panel, or is it much more a series of different samples that you're trying to make representative?
It's primarily the latter. Yeah. I think there are some advantages for tracking opinion change over time. That panel is really cool, but it doesn't make for a great pool of respondents for messaging experiments, because you'd be hammering the same people with message after message after message in different experiments, and they would sort of get saturated and quickly not look much like ordinary people anymore because of what they've been exposed to. So it's not a good fit for the kind of research that we do in our rapid message tests.
The question of, is anything working? What is working has come up. If you have a lot of people coming to you with a lot of these problems, you are learning across them. You are coming to understand what is helping the general cause that you support and by taking on these sort of clients. What can you say about like how we're doing in persuading and what kind of patterns are coming out that say, this is the type of thing that is moving an audience in the right direction?
Two thoughts here. We're leery of being prescriptive. We think it's not our role, but there's also this huge opportunity for people to learn from each other. We have a product called Persuasion Library, where most of our clients opt into sharing the messages and effects of their messages as they come out of testing. You know, it has thousands of messages in it, and you can click into a topic and see the distribution of which were effective and which were ineffective. You can dive into what they were and take them as jumping off points. So I just clicked into it and I clicked on the economy, where there's over 1700 messages in there, 6% of which caused a backfire effect, reduced support for the things that they were trying to move people on. 61% had a null effect or no detectable effect, and 33% were in the positive territory. I mean, there's something to learn from each of those categories. We see folks increasingly going there to learn lessons from their issue area, if they have one, but also from others, because an approach might work effectively across issue areas.
There are a couple other persuasion libraries out there that have come to my attention. And I think it's, to a certain extent, Annals Institute is something of a persuasion library, or at least it's a repository for a lot of testing across a lot of different things. And there's another one that Aaron Strauss is associated with it. What is different about your library? Should these libraries be combined? Is it too much a proprietary to your enterprise? Is there a way that we should be doing learning or less in silos than this might represent? What do you think about that question, Josh?
I think it'd be cool to do it less in silos. They're not always...
It is something that is of value that your firm provides. So it becomes an economic question for you as well as a ideological question or a question of value more broadly. Just that's the nature of an enterprise.
That's right. And The other differentiator, as I understand it, is that our clients are so diverse in what they test, or rather like what they're testing for, what kind of attitudes they're trying to shift. And so it makes it so that like what we're comparing in our persuasion library might not be comparable to what's in another. I don't know. I think if I were an organization out there, I'd probably try to get access to every persuasion library I could and get some value out of it.
To what degree do pollsters and media consultants and other consultants on persuasion use what you provide?
It's funny. I had a conversation about that yesterday. I think the persuasion library is kind of an offshoot. It's a growth out of testing that we are still, I guess, figuring out how to like market and package and get to people who could use it. But we're really interested to figure out, just because it's valuable, how to get it to more people who could use it. And that's sort of a business problem. It's sort of a process problem. It's sitting there, you know, waiting for people to get access to it. But that's the kind of unlocking that can get lost in the details a little bit.
Should someone doing direct mail who is choosing between two different kinds of flyers for the candidate, should they run those through your platform?
They should definitely run them through the platform, and they should look at Persuasion Library first to see, you know, what else people have done. Yes.
And do they at this point?
Yes.
Is that rare or is that common?
Increasingly common.
Yeah. What else would you guys like people to know about what you're up to or what you could be up to or how you could be helpful?
I think to kind of what Josh was talking about a second ago with like Persuasion Library, like one of our goals is to be able, you know, the whole idea is to build out this repository to be able to, one, have a place that people can go for idea generation and to see what's already worked and what hasn't. And to also be able to start to see some of those patterns and some of those trends in terms of what sort of values are working for certain groups of people and things like that. That's like something I'm really excited about that we're working on this year, and being able to just like provide more of those lessons. Again, with Josh and I both coming from the Analyst Institute, like that's, I think, one of the biggest value adds of Analyst Institute is to be able to have that repository and to be able to pull out lessons and patterns and best practices. And so I think, you know, having access to thousands of messages that are tested and being able to pull out patterns is going to be really valuable for people, and especially people who, again, don't have necessarily the resources to do a full-scale research plan where they're using a lot of different types of research. So
I'm mindful of what you said about not wanting to be prescriptive for their clients, but I'm also feeling like there might be some untapped expertise if you held to that too much. And I'm wondering, given that we're once again entering an election season that is going to be pivotal in an astounding way, most likely, to the direction of the country, do you have any thoughts about what people ought to be saying or not saying beyond trying stuff?
Sure. I mean, there's things that are obvious, like a whole lot of this elections discourse is going to be on the issue of abortion. And so test the messages that you're considering deploying there. But the advice I'd give beyond that, because I think that is obvious, is like something not being the most top of mind issue in the election doesn't mean that it can't be persuasive. If your side has an advantage on it, figure out how to leverage that advantage. I think we've seen some results on housing lately and some results on prescription drugs. Those aren't the two issues that people are going to say are like the top of mind heading into 2024. But if there are places where you have an advantage, figure out how to leverage it. There's a lot of that kind of advice that we can offer because we've seen people successfully run tests that do exactly that.
The way the Republican Senate campaign committee is trying to get Republicans to run away from the Alabama Supreme Court decision that embryos are people. They have just a ludicrous court down there. When you guys now observe politics, given that you're immersed in testing these messages and thinking about persuasion, has it changed just how you think about the daily news? Has it changed how you just are as a political observer?
I've tried to embody the attitude or the realization that a big proportion of the people we're trying to persuade aren't going to see most news. We have to do the work to meet them where they are. And maybe we can't just reference an Alabama Supreme Court decision, but we probably have to explain it from scratch, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And it's very curious how both sides, the people who make decisions who are wired into that, immediately went out with it. Democrats started to figure out how to employ that to sully the Republicans. And the Republicans immediately went out to block, right? That combat took place within seconds, more or less, in a day. Does that mean that both sides are making a mistake? Or can we say anything about our politics knowing what you know?
I mean, it seems like they're responding to the people who share the bubble with them rather than the person out in the world they're trying to persuade. And again, like, that's understandable.
Or are you wrong? And that, look, something so inflammatory that is on Fox right away, is on MSNBC right away. It's reaching a lot of people, and both sides have to attack and inoculate and cycle on it for those people who do pay attention. And it does permeate the electorate to some extent over time.
The great thing is, it's a testable question.
Yeah.
Not to come back to that, but of course, possibly I'm wrong. That's the humility I try to bring to it. But if you ask me, like, what do you think? Let's do the research.
Yeah. No, makes sense. Very fun to talk to you guys. Is there something I should have asked you that I didn't?
It's less of a question and more just like something I've been thinking about over this conversation. And also, I think, like, preparing to have this conversation is just like the necessity of persuasion. You will hear Josh and I, like, someone could probably do a drinking game out of this podcast episode, how many times we want to talk about approaching people with empathy. But I think that's really important, is like empathy and humility. We have to be able to look to understand people and not just sort of come from a place of like why they're wrong. And I want to just acknowledge like how hard that is. And I think especially for those of us who work in this world, as a queer person who is married to a non-binary trans person and a person who is a parent, the recent death of Nex Benedict, a non-binary kid who was attacked at school, has like absolutely ripped me in two. Do I want to engage with someone that doesn't automatically and inherently see the humanity of my family and my spouse? Absolutely not. There is so much at stake. I know we all know that, but I think like remembering that like people's lives are literally on the line for the things that we care about, I think it's just a good reminder for why persuasion is necessary and like why we have to approach it in that way.
And on that issue in particular, I would hazard the guess that the vast majority of our country is astonishingly uneducated about the issues around what's going on there. And I know that because I was astonishingly uneducated about it not very long ago. And maybe it's only through this podcast and people I've talked to and friends whose families have had to come to grips with the complexity of human life and preferences and biologies and socializations. I mean, that hasn't moved around, just like news. Information has not moved around. So we have to be a little bit open to fellow citizens being ignorant about important things, even though they are life or death in certain places to certain people. Josh, did you have one thing you want to say, or?
I think we should leave it there. That's perfect.
That was Josh and Mary at Grow Progress. They are at growprogress.ai. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.